tomorrow. Anna had now taken out a handheld activity centre that only she could play with, thereby excluding us. We returned to the living room, and while I read Paula and Adrian a story, Anna played independently until it was time to start their bath and bedtime routine. I usually take the children up in age-descending order, the youngest first and the oldest last, so it should have been Paula, Anna and Adrian, but I wasn't about to leave Anna downstairs unsupervised with Adrian. She was far too unpredictable and volatile at present. I took Paula and Anna up together, which gave Adrian the chance to watch the programme on the Tudors in peace. Upstairs, Anna told me bluntly she didn't want a bath. "You can have one tomorrow, then." I would never insist that the child has a bath or shower on their first night. To have to undress and bathe in an unfamiliar house while the carer hovers is likely to make the child feel even more uncomfortable. So I left Anna in her bedroom to change while I gave Paula a quick bath. Paula was exhausted. I tucked her into bed, then took Anna to the bathroom. "Do you need any help washing or brushing your teeth?" I asked her, as I would ask any child of her age on their first night.
"No, I'm not a baby," she snapped.
Nevertheless, I waited on the landing while she was in the bathroom. Then, when she came out, I took the opportunity to praise her. "Good girl, you did that nicely."
"I'm not sleeping in that room,"
she said, pointing down the landing to her bedroom, and began towards my bedroom. "No, love, you can't sleep in there," I said, drawing her out. "That's where I sleep."
"I'll sleep in your bed,"
she said, which I thought was an odd assumption for a child of her age to make. "No, you've got a nice room of your own," I said, closing my bedroom door. "I'll leave your light on low and your bedroom door open if you like." Many children prefer that.
"I sleep in my mum's bed at home," she said,
not moving from outside my bedroom. "Not every night, surely?"
"Yes, with Mummy now, but with Daddy as well before he left."
"But you're a big girl. You need your own bed." I moved away and led the way along the landing to her room. She followed. I doubted she slept with her parents every night, not at her age.
"I sleep where I want,"
she said defiantly as we went into her room. "Not here, love. We all sleep in our own bedrooms. Would you like your curtains open or closed?" Small details like this can help a child settle.
"Don't care," she said. "I'm not staying here. You can't make me."
"I'll close the curtains then and make it nice and cozy," I said, ignoring her rudeness. I then eased back the duvet and waited, wondering if we were going to have a standoff, but eventually she climbed in. "Do you have a cuddly toy at night?" I asked. There hadn't been one in the bag containing her nightclothes. She turned away without answering. "Would you like a goodnight kiss?" I asked, pretty sure of the answer.
"No. Go away."
"Okay, but don't be rude. It's bound to feel a bit strange for a while with everything new, but tomorrow you'll feel a bit better, and the next day, and the next. Try not to worry. I'll look after you. Call out if you want me. Night then, love." I waited, but there was no response, so I came out, leaving her bedroom door slightly ajar. I checked on Paula, who was fast asleep, and then went downstairs to Adrian. As I entered the living room, I heard movement on the landing and quickly returned upstairs. Anna's bedroom door was wide open, and when I looked in, her bed was empty. I found her in my bed. "Anna, I've already told you you can't sleep in here. Come back to your own bed. I'll stay with you until you're asleep if you like." It's not acceptable for a child to sleep with their foster carer. Only babies in cots can share their carer's room. Apart from which, it wouldn't be fair on Adrian and Paula if she slept with me. I eased back the duvet for her to get out.
"No," she said. "Not going."
"Why? What's the matter? Are you frightened of something?"
"No. I want to sleep here."
It seemed, therefore, it was more about Anna getting her own way than out of any fear or anxiety. "Come on, I'll stay with you until you're asleep," I said again, offering my hand.
"I'll scream if you try to move me," she threatened.
"You're still going to have to sleep in your room." I waited and then took her arm and gently eased her from my bed. She screamed all the way round the landing, waking Paula and bringing Adrian running upstairs to see what was the matter. "It's all right," I reassured him. "I'll be down in a few minutes." I returned Anna to her bed, asked her again if anything was worrying her. Then once she'd settled, I came out. I resettled Paula, but as soon as I was downstairs, I heard Anna's feet cross the landing as she returned to my bed. The pattern continued for most of the night. Each time she got up, I took her back to bed with her screaming and waking Paula, and then later Adrian. Goodness knows what the neighbours thought, but it wasn't the screaming of a frightened child, but one used to getting her own way. At 1 a.m. I stopped returning to my bed and sat on the landing ready to take Anna back to her room when she emerged. She was very angry at not being allowed to do as she wanted and tried to kick and pinch me. Eventually, at around 3 a.m, utterly exhausted, she fell asleep in her own bed. I waited 10 minutes and then returned to my room, shaken and drained. I couldn't ever remember having such a dreadful first night with any child I'd fostered before. Chapter 18. I Haven't Got a Home. The following morning we were all shattered, and it took a lot of coaxing and cajoling to get everyone down to breakfast on time. Anna was so tired she didn't have the energy to object to getting dressed. I'd set out her school uniform on her bed ready, or to eating the breakfast I'd prepared, which I think she might have done otherwise. Everyone was very quiet at the table as we ate. I saw Adrian and Paula stealing furtive glances at Anna, clearly concerned that the child they'd heard screaming, "I hate you," repeatedly during the night might reappear. Meanwhile, Anna kept stealing glances at me, not quite sure what to make of me. Perhaps I was the only adult who'd made her do as they'd asked. I didn't know. But I behaved perfectly normally, and I didn't refer to her tantrums of the night before. It had been dealt with, and I hoped that Anna had begun to see that when I asked her to do something, it was for a good reason, and I wouldn't be bullied into submission. I'd explained at the time why she had to sleep in her own room, and sometimes children simply have to do as they're told. Whether there would be a repeat of last night remained to be seen. I hoped not. I wanted Anna to be happy while she was with us, for however long that might be. Despite our lack of sleep, we did manage to leave the house on time, and so began our new weekday routine. With the children under seat belts in the back of my car, I drove first to Adrian's and Paula's schools, which were on the same site, saw them in, and then went on to Anna's school. Hers was on the other side of town, about a 30-minute drive in the traffic. We arrived with 10 minutes to spare. I parked, released my seatbelt, then, turning in my seat, asked Anna if she'd like me to read her a story from the book she had in her school bag while we waited until 10 o'clock, when she went in.
"No,"
she said sullenly, looking through her side window. She'd been quiet in the car, and a few times during the journey I'd asked her if she was all right. She hadn't replied, and at one point she'd looked as though she was about to nod off, so I thought she was probably just very tired. I switched the radio on low and tuned it to soothing classical music. Occasionally I turned in my seat to say something to Anna, trying to open up communication and establish a relationship. "It's a nice school. I'm looking forward to meeting your teacher and TA, teaching assistant. What do you like doing best? You could invite a friend home for tea," and so forth. She ignored me and continued to gaze out of her side window. Just before 10 o'clock, I said it was time for us to go into school, so I got out and went round to open her door, which was child-locked. Now on familiar territory, Anna's assertiveness returned, and she strutted up to the main gate and pressed the security button, then went ahead across the playground to the main door, where she pressed the next security button. I joined her. The door clicked open, and she went ahead into reception. Two office staff sat at their computers behind a counter to my right, and one stood and came over.
"You must be the new foster carer," she said. "Yes."
Clearly Laurie had updated them so they were aware of Anna's most recent move.
"Can you fill this in, please?" she said, passing me a form. "Miss Rich, Anna's TA, will be down to collect her soon."
I filled in the form, standard questions for when a child moved home, asking for the child's full name and date of birth, my name and contact details, and my relationship with the child, foster carer. I handed it back. "I'd like to make an appointment to see Anna's teacher, please," I said. I always like to meet the child's teacher to find out how they are doing and what I can do to help them.
"That's Mrs. Taylor. She's left a note saying she'd like to see you. She's teaching now, but if you can come in half an hour early at 1:30 today, she will see you then."
"Wonderful. Thank you. That's very efficient."
"She is," the secretary said.
The door behind me opened and a slender, fashionably dressed young lady, I guess to be in her late 20s, came in and said hello to Anna, then to me.
"Hi, I'm Lauren Rich, Anna's TA."
"Nice to meet you," I said, going over, but my gaze went to Anna. Having rejected any contact with me, she made a point of sidling right up to her TA and now had her arm around her waist. While this could simply have been because she knew her TA well and felt safe with her, her expression said otherwise. The smirk said, "See, I like her better than you," which I ignored.
"I support Anna in the classroom, and also she is in a small group I take in the afternoon," Miss Rich said. "I know Mrs. Taylor, her class teacher, will tell you about Anna's progress when she sees you later, but do let me know if you have any concerns."
"Thank you. Her reading book and homework will be in her bag at the end of school each day. The homework is usually reading practice and a worksheet, maths or literacy. There is also a home school book in her bag where I write what they have to do, and also any comments about her day. Feel free to add anything that may help us here."
I thanked her again. She seemed very pleasant, and as I was the third carer she must have explained this to in a week, very patient.
I said goodbye to Anna and wished her a nice day, but she ignored me.
"Say goodbye to your carer,"
Miss Rich encouraged. Anna shook her head.
"Don't worry," I said. "You both have a good day and I'll see you later." Given all the issues I was having to deal with, the least of my concerns was Anna not saying a polite goodbye.
I arrived home at 10:30, so I had 2.5 hours before I had to return to Anna's school to meet her teacher at 1:30. The hall and front room were still clogged with Anna's bags and boxes, but before I tackled those, I needed to write up my log notes. I usually did them at the end of each day, but I hadn't had a chance the evening before, with constantly having to settle Anna. Foster carers are required to keep a daily record of the child or children they are looking after, which includes appointments, the child's health and well-being, education, significant events, and any disclosures the child may make about their past. When the child leaves, this record is placed on file at the social services. Over time, the logs can show the improvement or not the child makes, and also act as an aid memoir for the carer and social worker. With a mug of coffee, I took the folder I'd begun for Anna from the lockable drawer in the front room, and sitting at the table, wrote a few paragraphs about Anna's arrival. It was objective and, I hoped, honest. Returning the folder to the drawer, I then set about unpacking, taking up to her room the bag she needed now and leaving in the front room the bags marked summer clothes, outgrown toys, memory box and life story book and so forth. Again, I had that cold, sinking feeling. Why had Anna's mother packed all of this? It was Anna's history. Wasn't she going to try to bring Anna home ever again? The vast majority of parents whose children go into care would keep these things in the belief that their child would be returning home before too long, but it seemed Anna's mother had closed the door and said goodbye to her daughter for good. I arranged Anna's winter clothes neatly in the wardrobe and drawers in her bedroom, and her books, small toys and other knick-knacks on the shelves. She had come with 2 framed photographs, which I also put on the shelves, pausing to look at them. One was of a couple in their 40s whom I guessed to be Anna's parents, and the other was of a younger woman standing alone outside an old stone building in what looked like a cobbled market square. Who was she, I wondered? Then I saw the familiar likeness to Anna, and I guessed it was her birth mother. With her room looking more homely and the hall, but not the front room, clear, I had a quick sandwich lunch before setting off to Anna's school. As I drove, I thought about the photograph of Anna's birth mother, and also Anna's comments the evening before about the biscuits from her own country. Clearly her parents had worked very hard to make Anna aware of her roots and keep the memory of her birth mother alive.
I knew this would be considered appropriate and PC, politically correct, by the social services. So when and why had it all gone so horribly wrong? As with many children I'd fostered, when they first arrived there was a lot I didn't know and I'd learn more as time went by. Sometimes the child's teacher was able to fill in some background details, and the more I knew about Anna the better, so I could understand and meet her needs. I arrived at Anna's school 5 minutes early and signed in the visitor's book, then waited in reception where I looked at the children's artwork on the walls. Also on the wall was a laminate photo board with photographs of all the staff and their names beneath, including the caretaker and support staff. Mrs. Taylor, Anna's teacher, I guessed to be in her early 50s, and she had short, neatly cut hair and looked confident and efficient, as the secretary had said. When she came into reception, I recognized her immediately from her photograph. Wearing a tweed skirt, pale grey blouse and cardigan, she shook my hand warmly. "Mrs. Glass, lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming in." "Thank you for making the time to see me," I said. She seemed efficient, but also very personable and friendly. "Have you been fostering long?" she asked, leading the way out of reception. "Yes, about 9 years now." "Good. So I take it Anna won't have to leave you as she did the others?" "No, not until everything is sorted out and where she lives long-term is decided." Mrs. Taylor opened a door on our right and I followed her into a small room containing filing cabinets, a small desk and a couple of chairs. "Take a seat. We shouldn't be disturbed in here," she said as we sat. I met Anna's first foster carers. They were very pleasant, but apparently unable to deal with Anna's behaviour. I didn't meet the second set. Anna was in and out so quickly, and in my view, should never have been sent to them. "Unfortunately, there is such a shortage of foster carers that often there isn't a choice of where to send a child," I said. She gave a little sniff. "That's what her social worker said. Anyway, Anna is with you now, although probably more disturbed than ever by all the moves." What could I say? She was right. "I will do all I can to help her." Mrs. Taylor said, as though that remained to be seen. "What have you been told about Anna and her past?" She looked at me carefully. "I know she was adopted at the age of 2 and a half from an orphanage overseas and has since been diagnosed with an attachment disorder. Her father left home at Christmas and her mother wasn't able to cope with her behaviour alone." "That's about it in a nutshell. We've had Anna in the school since she was 3, so we know her and her parents well. She came to our nursery after being excluded from another nursery. Have you met her parents?" "Not yet. Hopefully I will before too long, or her mother at least. I don't think they know where the father is at present." Mrs. Taylor suddenly looked very sad. "I feel as if I have watched those poor parents unravel. They are a lovely couple whose hopes of a family have been dashed. It wasn't their fault. They were naive and bit off more than they could chew with Anna. They never liked to say no to her." I nodded. "Anna is fiercely independent, probably from having to be as a small child. She rejects help, advice, and comfort. Goodness knows what she went through in those early years, but problems began as soon as they returned home with her, even before, from what her mother Elaine told me. Elaine used to come in and see me and ask for advice. The school works very closely with parents, especially if their children are experiencing difficulties. They tried to deal with her as they thought fit. Then someone put the idea in Elaine's mind that the child probably had a disorder. She took her to a round of specialist doctors until eventually Anna was diagnosed with an attachment disorder." "You seem to think that might not be correct," I said. "Oh, I don't doubt that Anna has failed to bond properly. Presumably because of the neglect she suffered in those first few years. She displays all the symptoms of an attachment disorder, and we've asked for the education psychologist to be involved. But in my opinion, what that child needs more than anything, and has done from the start, is tough love. By that I mean firm boundaries for good behaviour, and love and support to enable her to move on from the past, rather than all that stuff about keeping her in touch with her roots." "I see," I said, taken aback by her directness. "I know what I'm talking about," Mrs. Taylor continued. "I've had first-hand experience. My sister has 2 adopted boys, brothers. They were 6 and 8 when they went to live with her and her husband. The horrors those lads had been through were unbelievable. The parents were sent to prison for what they did. The boys were in care for a year with four different sets of carers, all unable to control their behaviour before my sister and her husband adopted them. Feral was the word that came to mind. Their behaviour and problems were far worse than anything I've seen in Anna, but the difference is my sister had experience of working with disturbed children. Instead of feeling sorry for them and pandering to them, they were very firm from the start. They had to be. The boys were uncontrollable. They made sure they felt safe and set about changing their behaviour through a system of rewards and sanctions. I nodded. The social worker kept pushing for the boys to keep in touch with their natural parents, even visit them in prison. My sister and her husband refused, saying it would undermine what they were doing and hamper the boys' chances of being able to move on from the past. They always answered their questions honestly, and the lads knew that if they did want to see their natural parents, they could, but their past wasn't kept alive like Anna's has been. 8 years on, and both boys are doing well. The older one, who was more badly beaten, has learning difficulties, but they are both happy. As my sister said, the past is past, and the kids have their whole future ahead of them. I see so many comparisons between my nephews and Anna. Mrs. Taylor's eyes filled, and she reached for a tissue. You see, Anna is close to my heart, she said, a little embarrassed. We were silent for a moment. Anna has come with a framed photograph of her birth mother, which I put on a shelf in her bedroom, I said, now wondering if I'd done the right thing. She's brought photographs of her birth mother and what she refers to as my own country into school to show us. If you ask me, I think her past is ruining the present and possibly her future, although I'm sure her social worker would disagree. But what can we do to help Anna? Her life is in even more turmoil now. Does she have any friends? I asked. Not really. We're trying to teach her to make friends, but Anna can be very bossy and manipulative. She wants it all her own way, which, from my understanding, is what has been happening at home. She screams when she doesn't get what she wants, and it scares other children. She has also been quite cruel to some of the children. Her behaviour became so disruptive last term that we agreed with her mother to put her on a reduced timetable for now. I nodded. I've heard her scream, I said, for most of last night, because I wouldn't let her sleep in my bed. Does she really still sleep with her parents every night? I believe so, Mrs. Taylor said, raising an eyebrow. Her father had been sleeping in the spare room before he left. Anna was quite victorious when she told me. It's not good for a child to hold that sort of power. It's not good for the parents' relationship either. She paused, collecting her thoughts. In respect of Anna's education, her learning is behind what it should be. I'll ask Lauren Rich, her TA, to give you a copy of Anna's individual education plan. Thank you. I'll help Anna with her schoolwork. I have two school-aged children myself, so I always make time in the evening for homework. Good. Although, be prepared for a struggle. Her mother used to say that if Anna refused to do something, there was nothing she could do to change her mind. She often came in without her homework done. Is Anna going to see her mother? Not at present. She looked at me thoughtfully. If Anna doesn't return home to live with her parents, will she be able to stay with you permanently? I honestly don't know, I said. It will depend on the social services. She gave a half-hearted nod. I need to go to my class now. It's after 2 o'clock. Anna can go straight home with you, but please feel free to see me when you want. Just let the office or Miss Rich know. Thank you so much, I said. You've been very helpful. We stood and left the room. If you wait in reception, Miss Rich will bring Anna to you. I thanked Mrs. Taylor again, said goodbye, and returned to reception. Anna was already there with Miss Rich.
You're late, Anna said rudely.
I was going to let it go, but then she grabbed my arm, digging in her nails.
You're late,
she said again. Don't do that, please, I said, releasing my arm. It hurts. I've been to see your teacher.
Why?
She demanded.
Anna,
Miss Rich cautioned. To hear how well you are doing, I said, and how I can help you with your schoolwork. Come on, say goodbye. It's time to go home.
I haven't got a home, she said.
Yes, you have. It's with me for now, and I've made your room look really nice. Chapter 19 Memories Despite all my best efforts in trying to make Anna's bedroom look comfortable and homely, she didn't like it. To be honest, given how objectionable she was making herself, I'd have been more surprised if she had liked it, but her only comment was quite telling.
"That's my real mother,"
she said, picking up the framed photograph of her birth mother. "She's your birth mother," I said, "but your real parents are your mummy and daddy, the ones who adopted you." She glared at me as if I'd just blasphemed.
"You don't know!"
"Anna, I know your mummy and daddy must love you a lot, as you do them, but something has gone wrong between you. How much do you remember of the time before you came to England?"
"Lots," she said fiercely. "I know my real mummy."
"Do you really remember her, or is it that your mummy and daddy have talked to you about her and showed you photographs?" She looked confused, as well she might, and I was mindful of what Mrs. Taylor had said about the past intruding into and damaging the present.
"None of your business," Anna said at last.
"Don't be rude, love. It's not necessary." But Anna's past was my business. If I was going to be of any help to her, I needed to know and understand what her experiences and memories were. I had to try to break down the barriers that Anna had erected to protect herself. Not all at once, but little by little, over the coming weeks. I hadn't seen Anna smile yet, or allow herself to be pleased with something. I appreciated that she had a lot on her mind, but most children would have shown a glimmer of pleasure when something pleased them. A small example of this was the chocolate milkshake I made for her when we arrived home after collecting Adrian and Paula from school. She specifically asked for it when I offered everyone a drink, and clearly enjoyed it. But when I said, "You liked that, didn't you?" she scowled and pushed the glass away.
"No!"
When she wasn't scowling or looking angry, her face was blank and expressionless. Anna had nothing to do with Adrian and Paula that evening, and treated them as though they weren't there, although I saw her looking at them occasionally, and also at our cat, Tosha, whom I kept a close eye on. I didn't want her meeting the same fate as the last carer's cat. Children who are angry will grab and throw anything in sight, regardless of the harm they can do. A disturbed child in a temper is out of control and needs to be stopped for their own sake and for the safety of those around them. Anna didn't have any homework that night, and knowing I wouldn't be receiving much cooperation from her, and that everyone was tired from the broken night before, I began the children's bath and bedtime routine early. However, Anna surprised me by actually getting into the bath I had run at the first time of asking. She liked her bath, and I think she found the warm water soothing. It was getting her out at the end that proved the challenge. She refused, and eventually I had to drain the water, which led to her shouting,
"You can't do that!"
and
"I hate you!"
That's as may be, I thought, but she did get out. Similarly and predictably, Anna didn't want to sleep in her own bed, and I asked her again if there was a reason. She said,
"Because I always sleep in the big bed."
"Not here, you don't, love. We all have our own beds." Then followed a rerun of the night before, with me repeatedly taking her back to her own bed, in between seeing to Adrian and Paula. Anna grew increasingly angry with me as she couldn't get her own way, and threatened to bite and kick me. When she tried to carry out her threat, advancing towards me, I folded her arms across her chest and faced her away so she couldn't kick or bite me. Then I held her until her anger subsided. More like a hug than a restraint. She was only slight, and I'd had training in holding a child who was going to harm themselves or someone else. An inexperienced carer might not. Possibly her parents didn't physically stop her either, as an angry child who is out of control is frightening. But the person who is most scared of their behaviour is the child themselves. Having someone control their anger is reassuring and helps them. Eventually she calmed down, and I returned her to her bed again. To my great relief, clearly exhausted, Anna didn't get out of bed again after 11:30, and when I checked on her she was fast asleep on her side with her thumb in her mouth. I viewed this as progress. If I could shave an hour off this performance every night, by the end of the week, Anna should be asleep in her own bed at a reasonable time. Well, that was the theory, at least. I checked on Adrian and he'd gone off to sleep with his pillow over his head to block out the noise. I took it off, eased it under his head and kissed him good night. I went into Paula's room and she was just going off to sleep again after the last disturbance.
"I don't think I like that girl,"
she muttered sleepily. "Don't you worry. She'll get better with time," I said, and stroked her forehead until she was fast asleep. Anna slept through, and when I woke her the following morning and said it was time to get dressed ready for breakfast, she scowled at me but did as I asked. I viewed this as another small improvement. The school run went reasonably smoothly. I tried to engage Anna in conversation as I drove to her school, but she ignored me, so I switched on the radio. We waited in the car until it was time to go in, when Miss Rich met us in reception. We exchanged a polite good morning, and I checked with her that Anna hadn't had any homework the night before. She looked surprised.
"I left it at school by mistake," Anna said quickly.
That wasn't what she'd told me, nor apparently Miss Rich. "I asked you before you left yesterday if your homework was in your bag," Miss Rich said to Anna, "and you told me it was."
"Sorry,"
she said to me. "In future, I'll check myself." "No worries," I said. "We'll do what she missed tonight." If Anna thought she was going to get the better of two intelligent adults, then she was wrong. She was behind with her learning, and for her own good, she needed to do her homework. I drove home, where I had 3 hours before I had to leave again to collect Anna from school. Clearly, while she was on a reduced timetable, my days were going to be very short. My priority today was to sort and clear Anna's bags from the front room. It's unsettling for a child to see their belongings in bags, as it suggests they might have to move again soon. However, before I had the chance to get started, Jill telephoned to see how Anna was settling in and also to make a date to visit me. As my supervising social worker, she visited every month when we discussed the child I was fostering and my training needs, and she checked my log notes and generally monitored my fostering. Laurie telephoned straight after Jill, asking for an update on Anna and also giving me the date of Anna's first review. It was nearly an hour before I was able to tackle the bags in the front room. The first one I came across contained Anna's life story book. Children who are in long-term foster care or who are adopted often have a life story book. It is considered good social work and foster carer practice, and is a short record of the child's past for the child. It includes photographs, a brief narrative, and memorabilia that can be mounted in the book, such as examples of the child's drawings, school merit certificates, and cinema tickets. Larger items that can't be included in the book are often put in a memory box. These photographs and keepsakes supplement the child's own memories so they can retain a sense of their past. Anna's life story book was subtitled Our Adoption Journey. I was immediately transported back to a happier place and time. A photograph of Elaine standing in a child's bedroom and smiling as she packed children's clothes and toys into a suitcase. The caption read, "We are taking lots of warm winter clothes for our darling daughter, Anna. Mummy and Daddy are so excited." The next photo was of Ian holding the boot of their car with the caption, "Will all our luggage fit in? On our way to the airport." The next photo was a selfie of Elaine and Ian outside the airport with their luggage stacked high on a trolley. Then one of the departure board where they'd drawn an arrow marking their flight. Their boarding passes were mounted on the next page. Then a photograph through the plane window with the caption, "The sun rises on a beautiful day. 1 hour to landing." I sensed their mounting anticipation and excitement. Next was a photograph of a man called Danny standing beside a cab, and I read that he was the best driver ever. Then a photograph of the orphanage Anna had come to know as home. Grim and uninviting at best, in winter it appeared cold and bleak and quite haunting, surrounded by bare trees. I looked at it for a few moments and then turned the page. I was greeted with a photograph of Anna, aged 2 and a half, sitting on a beanbag between Ian and Elaine. A younger, smaller version of Anna, and her hair was much shorter now, but her clear blue eyes were unmistakable. Below was written, "Mummy and Daddy visited you every afternoon. We always brought toys and activities, but you preferred playing with our phones. On the opposite page was a photo of Anna with a phone held high in each hand while her parents looked on, smiling indulgently. There were more photographs of the playroom where we spent so much time, including a close-up of a brightly coloured mural on one wall. I turned the page again to a photo of Elaine and Ian looking very smart in suits with the caption, On our way to court, a very special day when Anna officially became our daughter. The next photo was similar to the framed one of Anna's birth mother that I'd unpacked and put in Anna's bedroom. I now realised it had been taken outside the court. The caption read, Anna's mother, a lovely lady, being very brave after the court hearing. We will never forget her. A lump rose in my throat and I looked more closely at the photo. The same blue eyes as Anna, but trying hard to smile. I could see how brave she was having to be as she struggled to maintain her composure. What had been going through her mind as she held it together long enough for the photograph to be taken? The last picture, the one Anna would remember her by. It was heartbreaking and I swallowed hard. I turned the page. Photographs of Anna in their hotel room. A foldaway bed was beside the double bed, but Anna was in that instead and playing with a mobile phone. Then a picture of her watching television, and the three of them having breakfast in the hotel. This was followed by pages of photographs of the area in which they must have stayed, with captions beneath explaining where it was. For example, Daddy pushing Anna on the swing in the park, and so on. The legal paperwork must then have been completed, for the next page contained a photograph of Anna's passport stamped with a visa, and one of her new birth certificate. Then began their journey home, the three of them. A photo of Danny unloading their luggage at the airport, the departure board with an arrow marking their flight. Three boarding cards, Mr. Ian Hudson, Mrs. Elaine Hudson, and Miss Anastasia Hudson. I knew from the essential information form that Anna's name had been shortened from Anastasia. Then a picture of Anna asleep on the plane, and then they were home. Tired, but very happy. There were photos of their first Christmas together, with Anna opening a sackful of presents, then beside a gaily decorated Christmas tree, although she wasn't smiling in any of the pictures. The three of them wearing party hats and having their Christmas dinner, followed by a photo dated the 28th of December and entitled Anna's Extended Family. It showed about a dozen or so people, including three children, posing in what must have been a relative's house decorated for Christmas. The last photograph was headed Happy New Year and showed Anna with her parents beside a picture of Big Ben striking midnight. They were raising their glasses to see in the new year. Beneath was the caption, A New Year, A New Start. And that was it. Their adoption journey had ended, and I assumed the photographs that followed in the last 2 years since the adoption were in their family album. I flicked back through the life story book, looking more carefully at some of the photographs. I suppose I was looking for any sign of where something might have gone wrong. But of course, a photo is a small moment in time, a second, not the full picture. Mrs. Taylor had said there'd been problems almost straight away. It was so very sad, from all that promise of happiness to the reality of now. I wondered how much Anna looked at her life story book. I hoped it wasn't too much. A life story book should be used with discretion to help answer any questions the child might have about their past, not as a constant reminder. Again, Mrs. Taylor's words came back to me about her sister's adopted children needing to move on from their past. I returned the book to the bag and took out the memory box, which had Anna's name on the front in fancy lettering. Inside it was a treasure trove of memorabilia from Anna's past. An empty milkshake carton that the tag said Anna had drunk in the car after leaving court. Then a wrapper from a packet of biscuits with the name and ingredients in a foreign language. The tag said, Anna's favourite biscuits. Pity we can't get them in England. So I guess these were the biscuits Anna had mentioned to me. I took out the clothes she'd worn at court, and then a crucifix on a chain in a box with a note saying it had been given to Anna at court by her mother. Birth mother, I found myself saying out loud. Elaine, you're her mother. Little wonder Anna is angry. To lose one mother is traumatic, but to lose your adoptive mother too was painful beyond belief. Aware that time was ticking by, I carefully returned the items to the memory box. I felt I'd been party to their adoption journey, and it helped me to understand, although clearly there was a lot I still didn't know. I continued sorting through the other bags and boxes and took them upstairs. The items Anna would need with her now I took into her bedroom, and the rest I stowed out of the way in the loft. Then it was time to collect Anna from school. At 2 o'clock, Miss Rich brought Anna to reception as arranged, and told me she'd done a nice piece of literacy work, but unfortunately there'd been an incident with another child in the playground, and as a sanction, Anna had lost some of her playtime. "Oh, dear," I said, frowning at Anna. It was important she knew I was disappointed with her behaviour, even though it had happened at school. Miss Rich said there was spelling homework in Anna's bag, and she'd checked it was still there. "Also," she said, looking a little uncomfortable, "I need to tell you that Anna said your son has been bullying her." "What? Adrian?" I said, astonished. "That's ridiculous. Anna hasn't had anything to do with him since she arrived. They're never alone together in the same room." "Anna said it just after she'd been told off in the playground for bullying the other child, so we thought it might be a reaction to that," Miss Rich added. I looked at Anna, who didn't meet my gaze. "You mustn't make up things like that," I said firmly. "It's very wrong and could get people into trouble."
"Well, he did,"
she persisted. "When? What did he do?"
"Can't remember,"
she said with a shrug. "No, because it didn't happen." She shrugged again. I didn't think Miss Rich believed her, but that wasn't the point. Incidents like this can have serious consequences for foster carers and their families. Any allegation made by a foster child is noted by the social services and investigated. If it is serious enough, the child can be removed from the carer and the carer even suspended from fostering pending an investigation. I'd make a note of what Anna had said and the circumstances in which it had been said in my log, and also inform Jill the next time we spoke. Worried, I said goodbye to Miss Rich and left the building with Anna. "You mustn't make up things," I said to her again.
"Can if I want," she returned.
"Anna, I know you're angry and upset, but trying to make trouble for others because you've been told off is not going to help, and it could lead to you having to move again to another carer."
"Don't care,"
she said, and that was part of Anna's problem. She didn't care. One of the symptoms of a reactive attachment disorder is the child's apparent callous disregard for consequences, others, and what others think of them. All children test the boundaries sometimes and say they don't care, but mostly children do care and want to do the right thing to please their parents or main caregiver. But because Anna hadn't formed a secure and meaningful attachment in those crucial early years, she didn't feel she needed to do the right thing or please others. The damage could be undone, but it would need the help of a therapist, so I hoped the referral Laurie was making wouldn't take too long. I watched Anna like a hawk once we were all home, and didn't let her out of my sight, but then I hadn't before. I also mentioned to Adrian that he wasn't to be alone with Anna even for a second. Sad though this was, I daren't risk her making more potentially harmful allegations. She wouldn't see the damage she could do. Adrian didn't ask why, but knew enough of fostering to appreciate that sometimes these steps were necessary. Aware that Anna was likely to be resistant to doing her homework, I created a small incentive and said we'd do homework before we had pudding. Anna liked her puddings. I fetched a school bag from where she'd left it in the hall and, returning to the table, took out the list of spellings she had to learn. Adrian had his homework and Paula was getting her reading book from her school bag. Anna spent a lot of time fiddling around, ignoring me, and avoiding what needed to be done, then said her spellings were too hard. "I'll help you," I said.
"I don't need your help."
"Okay, I'll listen to Paula read then."
"I want my pudding first,"
Anna demanded. "We'll have pudding after we've all done our homework."
"Why not now?"
she persisted. I heard Adrian sigh. "Because we'll do the homework first." I returned my attention to Paula, and eventually, after more fiddling around and trying to distract Adrian, she began learning her spellings. There were only six, but she did seem to find them difficult to remember. When I tested her on them, she only knew three well, but at least she had done as I'd asked, eventually. Because everything was such a struggle with Anna, we didn't have time to sit down together and relax as a family in the evening. After homework and pudding, I began their bedtime routine and steeled myself for more refusals and confrontations. It was 8:30 before Anna was out of the bath and in bed. Adrian and Paula were already in bed with their bedroom doors closed, so they would hopefully be able to get off to sleep. I took up my place on the landing, ready to return Anna to bed with minimum disruption. She was persistent, to say the least. Old habits die hard. If she had been sleeping with her parents every night, it would take time to change that. There was less screaming and kicking tonight, and when she was in her bed asleep at 10 o'clock, I viewed it as a huge step forward. I still had time to go downstairs, make a cup of tea, and write up my log notes before going to bed. I'll admit that looking after Anna was stretching me to the limit. I went to bed exhausted and was continually on guard. I could understand why the previous carers had given up so quickly. Looking after Anna wasn't the joy of fostering a child who just wanted to be loved and cared for. It was part of Anna's condition that she gave the impression she didn't need anyone. I knew from my training that managing her behavior was paramount, but I could only do so much. Once in therapy, she would hopefully be helped to understand her own emotions and taught to appreciate those of others too. Chapter 20. Bad at Home. The strain of having Anna to live with us was taking its toll on Adrian and Paula. Since she'd arrived, I had hardly spent a minute with them, and they were looking forward more than usual to spending the day with their father on Sunday, when he would take them out somewhere nice. He saw them every month and phoned in between. Regardless of what I thought of him leaving us, I didn't let it impact on Adrian and Paula's relationship with him. I told Anna they were seeing their father, and I wondered if this would prompt a comment from her about seeing her own parents. She'd hardly mentioned them at all since she'd arrived, which was very unusual. Most children who come into care, even those who've been abused by their parents, pine for them, want to see them as soon as possible, and often ask when they can return home. Anna had originally said she didn't want to see her mother. Had that changed? Apparently not. She didn't mention wanting to see her parents at all, not then at least. Once Adrian and Paula had left with their father, I asked Anna what she would like to do and suggested the cinema, a park, the weather was cold but dry, or an indoor activity center. She didn't want to do any of these, so I said we could do something at home then. She shrugged and didn't offer a better suggestion, so I opened the toy cupboard in the conservatory and asked her to choose some games we could play together. The phone rang and I answered it in the living room. It was my mother. We usually spoke a couple of times a week, but now I said I'd have to call her back later for a chat. When I returned to the conservatory, Anna was nowhere to be seen. I'd only been away from her for a couple of minutes. I went round the downstairs, calling her name, and then upstairs. My bedroom door was wide open, and I went in to find her going through my wardrobe. "Anna, whatever are you doing?" I asked, going over.
"Nothing,"
she said, but she didn't immediately stop. "That's private," I said, and closed the wardrobe door. "Do you remember when you first arrived, I explained our bedrooms were private, and we didn't go into each other's rooms unless we were asked?"
"You go into mine," she said.
I was taken aback. It wasn't the reaction of an average 5-year-old, even one with behavioural issues. "Yes, because I am your carer and I look after you. I go into your room to make your bed, put your clothes away and keep it clean and tidy. At your age, it's part of my responsibility. When you are older, you can do it yourself. Now come on out of here. We're going downstairs to find a game to play." She didn't move, but stood with her back to the wardrobe.
"I go into my parents' bedroom whenever I want," she said brazenly.
"Well, that's up to them," I said.
"No, it's up to me."
I believed her, and not for the first time I saw that the distinction between adult and child in their house had become blurred. This, among other things, would make disciplining Anna very difficult. Children need to see the adult in the parent, set apart from them, in order to respect and be guided by them, until they become adults when, hopefully, they have learnt what they need to be responsible for themselves. Well, in this house, we don't go into each other's rooms unless asked, I reiterated. Now come on downstairs and I'll choose us a game to play. This was enough for her to leave.
I'm going to choose the game, not you!
She rushed out. I closed my bedroom door. I didn't want to have to start locking it as I had done with one young person I'd fostered, but I might have to if Anna kept going in. Apart from the privacy issue, I had items like scissors and nail varnish remover in my room, which could be harmful in a young child's hands. Downstairs, Anna was already rummaging in the toy cupboard. Taking out a large, brightly coloured jigsaw puzzle suitable for quite young children, she took it to the table. I sat on the chair next to her, but it soon became clear she didn't want me to join her, so I simply sat beside her. When the puzzle was only half complete, she gave up, despite my offer to help her finish it, and chose another. The second didn't get completed either, but the third did. Then she wanted a crayon, then 10 minutes later paint, then model with Play-Doh, and so the day continued with a break for lunch. Usually when I have one-to-one time with the child I'm fostering, I find our time together is enjoyable and it advances our relationship with the opportunity to talk and break down barriers. But I didn't feel that with Anna, not at all. Although I stayed close by her as she played, she didn't want me to join in any of the activities and continued to reject me and shut me out of her world. Any questions or comments I made, she answered with a shrug or don't know, or she just ignored me. It was hard work and the day disappointing. Also, not only had our one-to-one had no positive effect on Anna, I discovered later it had actually had a negative one. When Adrian and Paula returned, Anna clearly resented them being back, as she was no longer the centre of attention. She told Adrian she didn't like him and that his father would die soon. Anna, that's a hurtful thing to say and untrue, I said. She shrugged dismissively, then pushed Paula out of her way so hard she fell over. I told her off again and said she'd lost television time. It was an impotent sanction as Anna barely watched television, but I had to do something.
Don't care,
she said, and clearly didn't. The atmosphere was strained, with Adrian and Paula even more wary of Anna now, and at dinner they weren't their usual chatty selves after a day out with their father. Of course, I felt guilty for allowing this to happen. After dinner, I read to Adrian and Paula while Anna, who didn't want to listen, played with one of her toys. Then I began their bath and bedtime routine, taking Anna and Paula up first.
Why do I always have to go up before Adrian?
Anna grumbled. Because you're younger than him. It was around 10 o'clock again when Anna finally settled and stopped getting out of bed, and as usual, once asleep, she slept through until I woke her the following morning for school. I praised her, but not too much, for my amateur psychology said that if Anna thought she was starting to cooperate, she would rebel and go back to square one. The following night, to my absolute delight and relief, after I'd said good night and come out of her room, she didn't leave her bed, not once, nor the night after, so I knew we had turned a corner with this issue at least. She might relapse, but it would be easier to correct the next time. The hard work was done here. And this wasn't just about us all having a good night's sleep, but about Anna doing what the adult looking after her had asked. The next morning at 11 o'clock, Jill visited as arranged. I made us coffee and we settled in the living room, with the heating turned up and Tosha asleep on her favourite chair. Her visits usually lasted about an hour, but she was with me for nearly two as there was so much to discuss, an indication of how complex Anna's needs were. By the time she left, there was just an hour before I had to return to collect Anna from school. The next time I'd see Jill would be at Anna's review in 3 days' time. As well as managing Anna's challenging behaviour, I was trying to help her sort out the muddle of thoughts about past and present and who her real parents were. The longer Anna was with me, the more I appreciated what her teacher, Mrs. Taylor, had said about Anna confusing the past and present. So successful had Anna's parents been in doing what is seen as the right thing and making Anna aware of her origins that it had created confusion, mixed loyalties, insecurity and uncertainty in her. If I asked her about home, she was unsure if I meant the orphanage, home with her birth mother, or home with her adoptive parents. Similarly, if I mentioned her mother, she'd say, "Which mother?" She told me her father was dead. I didn't know if her natural father was dead or not. The paperwork didn't say, but certainly her adoptive father, the one she should have thought of as her father, was alive. Laurie was in the process of tracing him. What I also noticed was that if Anna mentioned a memory from her early years before the adoption, it was always of a scene in one of the photographs in her life storybook. Sometimes she repeated the caption her parents had written beneath, for example, "My mother is a lovely lady. She was very brave outside the court," or "I went on a plane, an hour to landing," so that I thought most of her recollections were in fact false memories from the life story book. If I asked her anything outside of these, such as, "Did you have toys at the orphanage?" or "What did you have to eat there?" she didn't know. I'm not saying she didn't have any memories of her early years, just that most of what she believed she remembered appeared to be from the photographs and what her parents had told her. It was something I would bring up with her social worker and possibly at the review. All children in care have regular reviews. The child's parent or parents, social worker, teacher, foster carer, the foster carer's supervising social worker, and any other adults closely connected with the child meet to ensure that everything is being done to help the child and that the care plan, drawn up by the social services, is up to date. Very young children don't usually attend their reviews, whereas older children do. I'd received the review forms in the post, which Anna and I were expected to fill in, and I would take to the review. There'd been a note enclosed from Laurie saying she wouldn't be able to see Anna before the review, but as her parents were being invited and there was no contact at present, she didn't think it was appropriate for Anna to attend. At her age, not many children did anyway, and their views were expressed through the review form and their foster carer. Given Anna's general lack of cooperation, I wasn't expecting her to be at all interested in completing her review form, but the expectation is that the carer tries. It is a child-friendly booklet with colourful illustrations and questions designed to ascertain the child's feelings and wishes on being in care. After dinner that evening, I asked Anna to remain at the table while Adrian and Paula went into the living room, and taking the booklet, I sat beside her and explained about the review and the questions. She was interested and grabbed the booklet from my hand. I knew she couldn't read the questions or write her responses, so I said, "I'll read the questions to you, and then you tell me what you want to say, and I'll write it." This was what I usually did. She nodded, which was a first. "Great!" I picked up my pen, slid the booklet so it was between us, and I could see the words and read out the first question. "Do you know why you are in care?"
"Yes,"
she said. "Can you tell me why?" I encouraged, "so I can write it down." She thought for a moment.
"Because I've been very bad at home."
I looked at her, taken aback. "No, love, that's not the reason. You're not bad. Your mother was finding it difficult without your dad and needed time alone." No child should ever believe themselves to be bad, and it wasn't Anna that was causing the problems, but her behaviour.
"Mummy needed to be alone because of me,"
Anna said quietly and without emotion. "Who told you that?" I asked.
"No one. I just know."
I continued to look at her.
"Write it,"
she said, nudging my arm.
"Why aren't you writing? You have to write because I have been bad at home."
"You really want me to put that?"
"Yes."
So I wrote it. The next question asked if the child knew who their social worker was, and Anna shook her head. I told her it was Laurie, and then I wrote, "Anna didn't know her name, so I reminded her." I said the words out loud as I wrote them, so Anna knew exactly what I was writing. The next question asked, "Would you like to see more of your social worker?" Anna shook her head, so I wrote no. The next question asked what she liked about living with her foster carer.
"Nothing,"
she said, without any need to think. "Nothing at all?" I asked, feeling a little hurt. She shook her head. "What about the milkshakes and puddings I make you? You like those?"
"No, I don't."
"Well, you eat them." She shrugged.
"Write nothing,"
she said, nudging my arm again. So I wrote nothing, and wondered what the review would make of this. The next question asked what she didn't like about living with her foster family, and Anna had plenty to say.
I don't like you, I don't like Adrian.